Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment with the Greek debt crisis that has the leaders of France and Germany huddled in Berlin trying to avert a default that is all but inevitable. Matthias Venengo, a professor of economics at the University of Utah, who is in Geneva working with the United Nations Development Programme, joins us to discuss whether it will be an orderly default or a disorderly one that could drag down the Eurozone with it. Then we'll talk about the fate of Medicare that is apparently a key part of the president's compromise with the Republicans in both the big $4 trillion deal he wants and the $3.7 trillion deal the so-called Gang of Six senators are calling for. Ethan Rome joins us. He is the executive director of Healthcare for America Now, a public interest group defending the much-maligned healthcare reform bill that is supposed to reduce out-of-control healthcare costs that are the biggest contributor to the deficit. Then finally, Nicholas Johnson joins us. He is a former Federal Communications Commissioner, and we will talk about how citizens in a democracy can take back the public airwaves media tycoons like Rupert Murdoch have been allowed to take over, and not just increasingly control news and information, but own our politicians and decide who gets elected and who does not. Joining us now is Matthias Venengo, who is a professor of economics and Latin American studies at the University of Utah. He is currently in Geneva working with the United Nations Development Program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthias Venengo.
Hi, nice to be with you.
And the European leaders are meeting in Berlin, Sarkozy and Merkel in particular. This is considered, I think, the New York Times editorial said that Thursday's emergency summit meeting looms as a Lehman Brothers moment. Do you see it that way?
Not really. I don't think we reached that point at which, you know, Lehman, you know, was the point at which finally Paulson forced, basically, through Congress, a resolution and what eventually became TARP. The rescue of the banks. I don't think we're at a point in the European situation in which the major players have recognized, you know, the problem they have, that they'll have to restructure debt. And so I think tomorrow is just going to be a failed moment, and we'll still, you know, muddle through this for a few more weeks, perhaps, before a significant decision is made.
Well, haven't they been muddling through for the last year and a half? Isn't that the problem, that the European governments, particularly the French and the Germans, didn't deal with this earlier? And by putting these harsh austerity conditions on Greece, they have absolutely slowed growth down to zero. And frankly, it's exactly what the Republicans are arguing here in the United States, you know, that if their deficit and debt reduction plans were put into place and if Obama agreed to them, they would also probably suffocate growth here in the United States.
You're perfectly right. So I think that two things are important to understand in this. One is, you know, it's the question of accepting the fact that Greece will not be able to repay according to, you know, the original value of the debt. So, you know, it's impossible to be done, and we know that, and most people know that, so they have to recognize that there is a need for a restructuring or a default or restructuring of the debt or whatever you want to call it. The second point is a full resolution of the Greek, you know, crisis, and, you know, to some extent of, you know, Portugal, Ireland, and you know, possibly Spain. It's that they have to grow. You know, the important thing is to understand that debt crises have, for the most part, been solved by recreating the ability of the countries to repay the debt, and that goes through a recovery of economic activity. And fiscal austerity, you know, has, for the most part, failed at producing, you know, growth. And you know, there is an extensive record of IMF programs throughout the periphery, in Latin America, in Eastern Europe, in fact, even in this crisis, that shows that, you know, that austerity will not work. So they're insisting on two wrong things. They're insisting on the idea that somehow, magically, if they produce austerity, you know, that will solve the problems. And second, that no restructuring of the debt will be necessary. Both things are absolutely, inconsistent with the evidence that we have of previous situations.
So already the EU has given $110 billion in a rescue package for Greece in cooperation with the IMF. And then only weeks later, they agreed on a €750 billion euro rescue fund for other potentially illiquid Eurozone members. So what is this meeting that's taking place in Germany with these top European leaders? What are they going to propose here? Because it looks to me as if Greece may actually be insolvent, not just illiquid.
At the end of the day, countries, don't go bankrupt. So the difference here between being illiquid and insolvent, it's the problem with Greece is that Greece has, big difference between Greece and the U.S., I should say, is that where the whole American situation hinges on a particular rule that forbids the government to, increase debt beyond a certain limit. But that debt is all in domestic currency. So it's domestic currency, that it's only partly owed to external, countries. So 30% of American debt is held by foreigners, or treasury bonds are held by foreigners. In the case of Greece, the problem is that Greece doesn't have a currency. And so the debt is fundamentally, an external debt. So Greece is really more like a Latin American country back in the 80s that borrow in dollars and has to pay in dollars. So what Greece needs to do is to export more than it imports in order to obtain the euros that it needs to pay. And the problem that to do that, the easiest way would be to devalue. And they cannot devalue while they're in the euro. So the only possible solution, which is not on the table tomorrow, kind of trying to reply your question, what are they going to propose? They're going to propose, I assume, that what they're trying to negotiate is some sort of a reduction of payment and extension, reduction in interest and extension of payment, which, it's fundamentally what a, rescheduling of debt is. And that is not going to be sufficient, you see, because that won't solve the key issue of the ability of the Greek economy to export more and import less. The only thing that, in fact, austerity is doing is by reducing GDP and by reducing the ability of Greek consumers of buying things, it's reducing imports, but not in a good way. So not in a way that allows them to go and pay, to some extent, if we're cynical, we can say that the other thing that they're doing tomorrow is trying to guarantee that German and French banks receive their money. So that's fundamental. It's not about the German people or the French people. It's about bondholders, and fundamentally those are banks in those countries. They are the Greek.
It's not about the Greek people, though. It's not about rescuing the Greek people either.
Oh, no, not at all.
They're the victims.
So that's definitely, again, a very typical thing would be, example would be the Latin American lost decade of the 80s. So there were significant pressures by the IMF and certainly by, Washington at that point to force austerity programs in Latin America in order to get basically Citibank and other American banks to get the money back at the expense of the people in Latin America. I should say, in the case of Latin America, for example, a good chunk of the debt was taken by authoritarian governments back in the 70s, which would suggest that a good chunk of the debt wasn't really the responsibility of the people of those countries. In the case of Greece, to a great extent also, the German banks and the French banks that put money in Greece, they already knew of all the problems that were going on, and they were counting on bailouts. And this, again, has some similarity with the American situation. It's the idea that, they're too big to fail and, taxpayers have to foot the bill. In this case, there is a, intra-European problem because the taxpayers that are, footing the bill at the end of the day are in the periphery of Europe and, the banks are, in the central countries. But still, it's very much the same thing. Is, you leave the people that sometimes, you know, with faults of their own, but several times not, that lost their houses, you know, without any, you know, plan to, you know, to rescue them. But you know, through the Fed, you put money into the banks because, you know, they're too big to fail.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthias Venango, who is a professor of economics at the University of Utah and is in Geneva working with the United Nations Development Program. And we're talking about a European summit on Greek debt, which apparently there are three options that are being discussed here. The first would be the Eurozone bailout fund finances a buyback of Greek government bonds at their current distressed prices. The second option would be a proposal made by French banks several weeks ago that would reinvest part of the money they collect from maturing Greek bonds into new bonds with long repayment deadlines. And the third option proposes a tax on the financial sector to recoup part of the cost of rescuing Greece. That's apparently the least likely option. But in a simple sense, surely, Matthias, does it come down to whether or not there will be an orderly default on the Greek debt or a disorderly default?
Again, I think you're right. So given that, you know, most observers have accepted on some level that the Greek default is unavoidable. And so the question here is not so much when, you know, if, but when. And so there are two options. They muddle through and continue to muddle through the whole process until they have a disorderly, you know, fault, which may be problematic for the world economy as a whole, not just for Europe, in the sense that, you know, German banks and French banks and British banks that are holding, you know, lots of these assets have interconnections with American banks and all through the world, and so this may again have a ripple effect throughout the world and an effect on trade and so on and so forth. And you know, if they just muddle through this, you know, and you know, we'll end up again on that sort of crisis, that would be a Lehman, you know, sort of moment. The alternative is to, you know, it's to basically say, look, this cannot be done, you know, in the current situation, and so they would need to do, you know, if they're not willing to consider alternative measures to increase, you know, Greek competitiveness, so the ability of the Greeks to repay, they'll have to do significant haircuts on the gains of the banks. And also they'll have to do significant fiscal transfers from you know, Germany and you know, and the other central countries in Europe to Greece. So allow Greece to grow in order to repay rather than contract. And contract, which eventually will lead to the collapse of the whole thing. I don't see, you know, to tell you the truth, I don't see the political will at this point to actually move in a positive solution. So an ordered default, it looks likely to me, it looks significantly, you know, possible that not only we'll have a disorderly collapse later, but also that this collapse will lead to Greece leaving eventually the euro. So I think it threatens the euro seriously, the inability to deal with this, and it puts other countries that are on the verge, like, you know, Portugal and, you know, Ireland and Spain and even Italy since last week, on a difficult situation if they want to stay within the euro. So it puts the whole project of the euro at peril. I think it's increasingly difficult to see how the euro will survive this situation.
So this is particularly scary news here. Matthias Venango, again, professor of economics at the University of Utah, and he's in Geneva working with the United Nations Development Program. The pattern here, though, has happened in Argentina, it's happened in the United States and recently, and it's still happening in the United States, and it's happening in Greece, and that is that irresponsible lenders get off the hook because the taxpayer has to bail them out. Irresponsible borrowers, whether they're democratic governments or authoritarian governments or criminals like the Argentinian
military junta, yeah.
Yeah, the military junta. And in the case of Carlos Menem, who ran up all those debts and borrowed prolifically, the bottom line is whether they're dictatorships or democracies or crooked governments or bad leaders, at the end of the day, it's the banks get bailed out and the people have to suffer, and it's systemic. And I'm wondering whether there's got to be a better way, because this is not just Greece. As I say, this is happening in the United States. It happened in 2008, and we're still paying the price.
Sure. Jeff Madrick has a new book called The Age of Greed, in which he tells how this pattern within the U.S. has been a pattern. Yeah, Citibank has been bailed out. It's amazing. You know, in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, and basically now again with this crisis. So it's a global pattern in which finance has had the upper hand, and fundamentally, the process has been about financial, short run gain. Bubbles that burst, and then we privatize the gains and nationalize the losses. They have gone hand in hand, particularly in the U.S. The U.S. is particularly bad in that respect, even when you compare it to other countries, with an incredible worsening of income distribution. So the middle classes have been squeezed. In some parts of Latin America over the last 10 years, things have changed. In Europe, the squeeze was certainly, to a lesser extent than in the U.S. But there is a general pattern. You're right that there is a general pattern of financialization, and that pattern has been one in which we accept that everybody is responsible for paying the bill when this financial crisis occurs. I would suggest that part of the problem is that, on a national basis, in the case of, within the U.S. and within other countries, there has been a movement away from the sort of separation of investment banking, the speculative part of the banking system, and commercial banking. So it's one thing when Roosevelt did, insurance against deposits. It was against, fundamentally trying to save people's, savings, not trying to, save, crooked bankers. So it's as if we went out and, tried to rescue Bernie Madoff, but, forget about his, the people that, deposited the money with him.
The victims.
So backwards. Globally, there has been a push also for eliminating capital controls that are now in the free movement of capital, and this crazy unregulated movement of financial derivatives. At the peak it was something like $600 trillion. So we're talking about the notional value of derivatives was 10 times the size of global GDP. So it's certainly out of proportion with the needs of the economic system.
Well, I thank you for joining us here, Matthias Venango. It's an interesting, albeit disturbing, conversation we're having. And it does seem that the political authorities, whether they're in Germany, France, or in the United States, do not seem to have power over the banks and do not seem to be capable of legislation or policies that are able to deal with these crises in a way that they get settled without the kind of pain that has resulted.
Let me say something here, if I may, briefly. I think that there is an analogy here with the Murdoch story and the hacking and whatnot, in the sense that, although several people knew that this was a process that in many levels was corrupted, he was at least seen as too powerful by politicians to be directly attacked or regulated or, somehow his power limited. The same goes with financial markets. You have to understand that most of the money that goes out for, political parties, it is in one way or another associated to, financial markets, and they have an incredible power of stopping regulation and stopping the political powers of regulating them, to the level that, if you look at the Treasury in the U.S., we have had several Treasury secretaries that came directly from Goldman Sachs and, and several other levels of government. So the quip from the film is a job that, this is an inside job to some extent. It's correct.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Matthias Venango.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthias Venango, who's a professor of economics and Latin American studies at the University of Utah. He's currently in Geneva working with the United Nations Development Program. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. Your love gives me such a thrill, but your love won't pay my bill.
Doctor, please, some more of these outside the door. She's a four-more. What a drag it is getting old. Men just aren't the same today. I hear every mother say they just don't appreciate that you get tired.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Ethan Rome, who is Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now. Ethan Rome has been a grassroots and labor activist and organizer for more than 25 years. Prior to joining Healthcare for America Now, he directed public affairs for AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. He also worked as chief policy and political advisor to the Connecticut Speaker of the House of Representatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ethan Rome.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
And clearly there's a couple of plans here on the table and some doubt as to whether the new plan, the so-called Gang of Six plan, can be addressed. Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, threw some cold water on it. Prior to that, of course, there was an even bigger deal, the $4 trillion plan of President Obama's. Now, what we hear about that, and I don't know how solid this information is that what was put on the table there in the $4 trillion deal that Obama wants was cuts to Medicare and perhaps changing Social Security around. Perhaps changing the eligibility time that both Medicare and Social Security come into play. So what do you know about that? Because it's created, as you well know, a great deal of indignation in progressive circles.
Well, there's a lot of lack of clarity about what's really going on right now. There's a new proposal by the so-called Gang of Six, which is a bipartisan group of six senators, and they've made a proposal that's come out today, been welcomed by the president, and it has been appropriately criticized by people who care about Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid. If you care about health care, this is a bad budget. If you care about Social Security, the Gang of Six budget is a bad proposal. And what they want to do is they would immediately slash $500 billion in spending. They would then follow it with a fast-track process for additional spending cuts and tax proposals, mostly loopholes for the rich and big corporations, that would total $3.7 trillion. And when you're done with the numbers, the bottom line is this. They want to take money out of the pockets of people on Social Security. They want to reduce Medicare and Medicaid benefits. Most of these proposals basically add up to shifting costs to poor working and middle-class families and senior citizens and calling that a good idea. And they then reduce taxes for the very rich and actually even increase taxes for middle-class families. They want to eliminate the tax exclusion for health care benefits, which we've all enjoyed for many, many years. So it's a dangerous time because people are caught up in this fervor of bipartisan. And the notion is that if you get a couple people or six people from two different political parties, and if they have a bad idea, it's somehow become a good one. And it's not. And so the concern we have about this latest so-called Gang of Six proposal is pretty simple. A budget deal that devastates America's seniors and middle-class families, that also lets big corporations and the wealthy off the hook, it's a bad deal for America, even if it is bipartisan, and even if it would theoretically get us out of this default crisis.
But Ethan Rome, this is such a sucker punch. I don't understand how any Democrat could fall for it. This is an economic hostage crisis that is entirely manufactured by the Republicans over this phony debt issue. You can argue also that the deficit's a phony issue, and we can get into that later. But you're saying now, you know, they've got everybody thinking, oh, my God, we've got such a crisis, let's be bipartisan about it. And in being bipartisan, they sell out the store. The bottom line is that this is an economic hostage crisis created by the Republicans who will benefit from a distressed economy, and the Democrats will be blamed for the train wreck. I don't understand how they could have got themselves in this situation. But what happened to the revenues? In the $4 trillion deal, as much as we know about it, the big deal that Obama wants, apparently Boehner agreed to $800 billion or $1 trillion by ending the tax cuts for the wealthy. In the $3.7 trillion deal that everybody's lauding as a great bipartisan step forward, where are the revenues? What are the rich going to pony up with?
Well, there aren't any substantial new revenues, and they don't eliminate tax cuts for big oil. They do, in fact, create new tax cuts. There's a tax cut by lowering tax rates, by permanently repealing the entire $1.7 trillion alternative minimum tax. I mean, what's extraordinary about this whole thing, and just if we step back from the numbers and the debates and all of that, is it's pretty simple. Every one of these budgets, particularly when it's supposedly bipartisan, it's balanced on the backs of poor, working, and middle-class families and seniors, and rich people get off the hook. They want to go after entitlements, so-called entitlements to health care that people depend on for their lives. And meanwhile, they assume that rich people are entitled to unlimited amounts of money from everyone else who pays taxes. And that's what's outrageous.
Yeah, Ethan, welcome to America. That's the facts. I mean, we have reached a point in this country where money is more important than votes, that the power of money has transcended the power of votes. And if you look at the last election in 2008, 140 million people voted. That's when Obama and the Democrats were swept in. In 2010, only 75 million people voted. As long as the rich control the political process and the Supreme Court's given them a blank check, and the average poor people don't vote, we're screwed.
Well, I think you should be on your own show.
No, I don't mean to step on you in any way.
It's terrific. But here's why I'm hopeful, which is that President Obama shares our values, and he knows what the right thing to do is, and the Democrats in both the House and the Senate know what the right thing to do is. It's their job right now to stand up and insist on doing the right thing, right? That we're not going to have a budget deal. There's not going to be a budget deal unless rich people pay their fair share. They could do Jan Schakowsky from Illinois. She's got a tax bill, raises taxes on the super, super rich, right? You know, 40-something percent for your second $1 billion. And, you know, that raises $800 billion, rather, in 1 year. So when there's all this talk about balancing the budget on Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, it's unnecessary. There shouldn't be that kind of talk. And, you know, the job of all of us, of everyone who's listening, is to buck up the Democrats in the House and Senate. They know what the right thing to do is. This isn't about numbers. This is about choices. It's about choices. It's about who you put first. And we need our government to put poor, working, and middle-class families first and not rich people.
Again, I'm speaking with Ethan Rome, who is the Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now. But, Ethan, since you work on the Hill, I would think that every Democrat, whether it's the President, anybody in the Senate, or anybody in the House, have to know that if they sell out the core values of the Democratic Party, the vestiges of the New Deal, if they don't stand by these things, they don't stand for anything. I mean, I can't imagine that you could go into an election year and have the Republicans say, oh, well, by the way, it's the Democrats who caved in on Medicare and Social Security.
Well, I mean, but listen, doing the right thing is good politics. And so standing up for the vast majority of people in this country is generally pretty popular with said vast majority of people. And so, you know, it's nuts to be taking the side of rich people. That's why we need the Democrats to stand up. The thing about today's so-called Gang of Six proposal is it's a reminder that every time they spin the budget wheel of misfortune, it always falls on the backs of poor working and middle-class families. And the tax wheel of fortune always lands on the rich. And that's what has to change. And so, sure, we've got to help people understand that what makes sense politically is also what makes sense from a policy perspective, and it's also the right thing to do. Supporting the middle class is good politics, and it's the right thing to do.
So let's talk about what you do, Ethan Rome. Again, you're the executive director of Healthcare for America Now, and you're trying to defend the much maligned, what the right call Obamacare, the healthcare reform bill. Now, I've seen ads on television with Huckabee telling the American people how dreadful this thing is. It's amazing to see to actually listen to this stuff, how people in this country could be beguiled into voting against their interests and not recognizing that every other civilized country has health care, and these shills are telling you to give it up, to give up this chance, or somehow it's going to be bad for you. But they're doing it. They're spending a lot of money, obviously. My understanding of the health care reform bill was that it was supposed to reduce at these out-of-control healthcare costs, which are the biggest contributors to the deficit. So who's making that argument?
Well, it will reduce healthcare costs. It's already beginning to reduce premiums in markets all across the country. It will reduce costs over time. It's not been implemented yet in terms of bringing new people online. But the biggest controller of healthcare costs in this country is Medicare. Medicare controls costs, while private insurance does nothing to control costs. So that's also why this debate about Medicare right now is crazy. It's the most efficient, cost-effective healthcare system in the world, and it's the only thing in this country that drives costs down. And so we need Medicare to be able to continue to do that. Certainly shouldn't be slashing people's benefits. Controlling costs, right now, the Gang of Six and folks like that, they somehow think that controlling costs is the same as cost shifting. And if you just make people pay more and make it harder to afford to live in their own country, it doesn't save anybody any money.
And what about the rumor that in both the $4 trillion deal that Obama put on the table and the $3.7 trillion deal of the so-called Gang of Six, that there's talk of delaying Medicare for a couple of years and the same with Social Security? Wouldn't that mean that seniors would be without coverage for two extra years?
That's a terrible idea. For a lot of reasons. If you begin with the people who won't have insurance, that's a bad idea. So for those folks. Secondly, it's a horrible idea for businesses, because mostly it just means that people stay on their employer's plan for two more years longer, and it also dumps older folks with higher health care needs into the employer-sponsored health care market. So that's another example where somebody is sitting around on the Hill and thought they had a good idea, and all they're doing is adding costs to those of us who already have insurance and hurting the people whose eligibility they delayed.
Well, I hope that none of these rumors are true then. That's all I can say, Ethan Rome, because the worst thing that could happen is that they could make a deal, right? If any of this stuff's true.
The next 13 days is, this is countdown. And I think that the key thing for all of us is to make sure and to buck up the Democrats who are on our side, to make sure that they stand up and hold firm, because now's not the time to buckle. The Republicans.
Let me wrap it up now then, because we've run out of time here. But I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Ethan Rome.
Thanks very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Ethan Rome, who's Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now. He's been Ethan's been a grassroots and labor activist and organizer for more than 25 years. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back, and we'll be joined by a former FCC commissioner.
Old people got no reason. Old people got no reason. Old people got no reason to live. They need lots of drugs, new hips. After falling down just a couple of steps, they need pacemakers. The cost is out of sight. I'd give them a pain pill and just say goodbye. We got.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Nicholas Johnson, who was a commissioner on the Federal Communications Commission from 1996 to 1973. He is the author of How to Talk Back to Your Television Set and Your Second Priority, A Former FCC Commissioner Speaks Out. He currently teaches at the University of Iowa College of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Johnson.
Thank you, Ian.
Clearly, the testimony before the United Kingdom House of Commons Culture Committee by Rupert Murdoch, his son James, and the head of News International, Rebecca Brooks, resulted, I think, in the notion that people in charge, and particularly the man in charge, simply doesn't know what's going on under him, and he's therefore not responsible. And in many ways, his defense was, my media empire is so big that I don't have time to deal with these small subsidiaries like his biggest circulation newspaper, News of the World. So that indicates to me that he's actually making a case that he is too big to fail, to use the banking analogy.
Well, yes, that's the way I would characterize it. When the bankers were saying we should give them billions or trillions of dollars, my reaction was, well, if it's too big to fail, it's too big to exist, and we ought to simply break it up. And I would say the same thing for a media conglomerate the size of something that the Murdochs have. If it's too big for them to be informed about this kind of event, too big for them to keep track of what's going on, I would say it's too big, and that it ought to be broken up. There are a lot of other reasons for breaking up media monopolies, if you can ever get the political ability to do so. But they're so doggone powerful and hold so much sway over the politicians, which was part of the problem in Great Britain, that and the same thing's true here, that it's often very difficult to do the right thing.
Well, but it's also pretty hard to believe that defense, frankly, or at least it's extremely convenient. And furthermore, who's responsible for the corporate culture but the people at the top? And clearly what was going on in England and in the tabloids in general that Murdoch owns around the world, and even here on Fox News, is a kind of no-holds-barred, you know, political bullying, intimidation. I mean, half of the candidates running for president on the Republican side up until recently already had contracts with Fox News. So it's not as if this culture is not being set by somebody.
Oh, sure. I think that folks find out pretty quickly what it is the boss wants.
And when you were on the FCC, it clearly wasn't as bad as it is now. But then I have to think back to the days of Colonel McCormick in the 30s, where he had a kind of used his media power as a kind of jihad against FDR. It's not uncommon for media moguls in this country to throw their weight around politically and make or break politicians. But has it gotten demonstrably worse?
Well, the bigger it gets, the worse it gets, because what we're talking about is a major source of power in a political system where the candidate has to get reelected and takes money from the special interests. But why do they have to take that money? Because they have to buy television time. And what it is they are buying with the money that is corrupting them is something that the media owner doesn't have to give money. It's something a media owner can give for free. They can provide favorable coverage to their favorite candidate and do them a lot of good that otherwise is going to cost them hundreds hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign treasury.
Well, clearly, media moguls are the beneficiaries of our broken political system, as you've just pointed out. Most of the money that politicians raise and sell their souls for goes directly to television monopolies during campaign season. And you better believe we're going to be seeing billions spent soon and certainly throughout the next year. And I take it, as was evidenced in some of the hearings in London, that it actually has the effect of politicians paying fealty to media barons. Whether they want it or not, politicians have become supplicants to these powerful people.
Yes, but to power of any kind. And one of the most important sources of power from the standpoint of somebody who, for some reason unbeknownst to me, wants to actually be reelected. You know, if the whole purpose in life is to keep your job, you're not necessarily going to do a very good job when it requires making some tough calls, as we're now seeing in this country. So a principal source of power are the media barons, and then the other is the special interest money. And you combine those, and you get what we're now seeing in Washington.
Well, you also have to add into the mix the fact that the Supreme Court has just opened the floodgates of unlimited corporate money and union money, which is by no means comparable. And we are now truly immersed in money-driven politics. So from your position as having been an FCC commissioner, where do we stand in terms of the public good versus the private interest? I mean, where's the pushback? Who's standing up for the citizen?
Well, I don't hear a lot. I mean, we had a public interest movement back in the 60s when I was on the commission, and you did have pushback, and you had an FCC that would occasionally consider holding a license renewal hearing. But now citizens, and I knew about a citizens group that put a lot of time and effort and their own money into putting together a very forceful presentation on why a station should not have its license renewed. This was recently. This was not when I was on the commission. They couldn't even get the commission to acknowledge that they'd received their petition. I mean, they wouldn't even answer their mail, let alone deal with the petition in a meaningful way. So we're in bad shape. It's not so much a question of where we stand, but where is it we're going to end up having fallen once we fall.
And of course, there was the recent shameful example of the FCC commissioner who, in a revolving door that was spinning out of control, she went straight from the FCC to head up with a big job with Comcast. And of course, Comcast was just allowed to buy NBC while she was sitting on the commission. So it's
right.
Pretty difficult not to connect the dots there. But again, you know, I'm sure we don't want to depress our listeners too much, Nicholas Johnson. And
we would like for them to wake up, however, and do what they can as citizens with the limited amount of freedom and influence that they still have in the political process to say something, get informed, and contact their representatives and senators and get out there and march if they think that'll do some good. And you do some creative. You're in California, aren't you, Ian?
That's right. And
I'm with the creative folks out there that know how to write and perform songs and put themes into television shows and whatnot. That's a source of power too, and it can be used on the people's behalf instead of to suppress them and drive us further into third world status.
Well, Nicholas Johnson, what about though alternative media? Because I'm I wish I was more effective, but I'm a part of the alternative media, and you know, we're not corporate controlled. We do depend upon money to some extent from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and as you know, the Republicans in the House are trying to shut down all funding, particularly shut down the CPB. But on the other hand, you know, there's about 1,000 college and community stations across this country, and I'm wondering what it will take to infuse and generate an alternative people's media, because the commercial forces and monopolies have taken over almost everything. And well, to my mind, you know, Nixon set up the public broadcasting to fail, and PBS now is more and more looking over their shoulder and looking for corporate sponsors, and they run advertising, making them indistinguishable from commercial television. NPR is looking over its shoulder, being attacked all the time. So there's not much left on the spectrum, except, to my mind, a few stations like the one that I'm on here. Do you think that there's any way to get the people's band organized and become a force against this tremendous kind of commercial juggernaut, which is largely pro-corporate and very right-wing in its political agenda?
Well, it's tough in a country where people are willing to vote against their own best interests because they've been informed or deceived, depending upon your point of view, with regard to issues that they believe they care about. But I think one area of hope, perhaps, is what the internet and the other social media and so forth have had some impact. I mean, when you can put a petition out and overnight come up with 50,000 signatures, that's a kind of power that we didn't have in the past. And even politicians who can use social media effectively, if you get somebody who will take a public stand, like Dennis Kucinich and Bernie Sanders, Senator from Vermont, and so forth. You got a smattering of folks like that, and they send out emails to their people. They have web pages, and they use Twitter and so forth. So there's that communications alternative that's available now.
Again, I'm speaking with former FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson, going back to Murdoch, just in the sense that, you know, he and his, particularly his son James, who testified with him, who did most of the talking, as a matter of fact, he has been outspoken in his denunciation of the BBC, and Murdoch would like to break the BBC. And I guess over here, since he's one of America's media moguls as well, it seems to me that even though you've got Fox as the number one cable news station, Limbaugh and all of his clones dominate commercial radio, and the big networks control network news, etc., why do they want to get rid of what's left, in other words, which is clearly the agenda in the current amongst the current House Republicans? Don't you think it's a bit greedy? They want to own the whole pie?
It's worse than greedy. If all it was greedy, you know, you could deal with it in those terms. But it's one thing to use what is supposed to serve the public interest as an instrument of unrelieved propaganda for a specific point of view, which just flies in the face of what those who created the FCC and the Radio Commission before it had in mind for American broadcasting. But it's something else, again, as you point out, to try to drive off of the air the few remaining sources of relatively unbiased, or at least alternative, let me say, points of view, so as to totally dominate the information and opinion and entertainment that's available. I'm very dependent upon the BBC. We get it on a local station. Well, I can get it on my laptop. I can get it on my iPhone. I can get it on a local radio station during the night from about 11 p.m. until 5 a.m. And, you know, the BBC is just wonderful.
But why don't we have one
detail about what's going on in countries that are not even mentioned as countries on American commercial broadcasting?
But why not have one here?
What's going on in the world? You have to listen to BBC.
I know, but why can't we have something like the BBC here in this country? We have the best standard we have for journalism is the New York Times, which is a family-owned paper. The Guardian, by the way, which is owned by a trust, is the one that broke the Murdoch story and stuck with it. But here we don't have what we have is so weak, and it's been weakened by politicians, I think deliberately so. How could you create a kind of BBC equivalent that could, I mean, they talk about diversity in the press, and that's what Murdoch said yesterday. That's what Murdoch said in his testimony, that we have great diversity. Well, that's absolute nonsense. We don't. But so let's talk about a way to create a kind of a BBC alternative in this country.
Well, you're right. The diversity that we have is Tweedledum and Tweedledumber. And you ask, why can't we have something like the BBC in the United States? Well, you might also ask, why can't we have universal single-payer health care like the major industrial nations of the world do? And it all comes full circle back to what we were talking about earlier. Well, where somebody running for the United States Senate every day knows that they've got to somewhere come up with $10,000 cash before the sun sets. 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year for 6 years. Their job really is to raise lots of cash. And where it comes from are the folks who expect what, in my research, indicates it ends up being a 1,000-to-1 return on their investment. You give $1 million to a political party for its national convention or to the national party as distinguished from individual candidate, and you'll get $1 billion in return of, you know, maybe it's tariffs or tax breaks or price subsidies, or they're all kinds of defense contracts, they're antitrust exemption. There are all kinds of things the government can do, most of which take taxpayers' money, but not all of which take taxpayers' money. Some just permit you to go on doing what you were doing, like BP and its dangerous conditions on the offshore drilling rig, or Massey Coal. It has over 700 citations for unsafe conditions, and the regulatory agency never did anything about it. Well, that's worth millions and billions of dollars to corporations to be able to run roughshod over the law. Or as I used to say, the problem is not so much that corporations violate the law, it's that the corporations write the laws. But as we see with the Murdoch operation, they're violating the laws as well as writing the laws. So that's the problem. As long as you've got the best government money can buy, and that's your driving force, you're not going to have universal single payer. Mm-hmm. You're not going to have the equivalent of the BBC.
Well, just in closing then, let's try and figure out that, you know, the BBC, of course, is immune from political influence because their funding comes from people who buy licenses every time they buy a TV or a radio,
yeah.
And it's insulated them. Is there a mechanism or is there a way to use the internet? Because people are searching out for the truth. I think people know. I mean, look at Jon Stewart. He's one of the most popular broadcasters around, and his job is to show how absurd the news is.
And?
Well, I'm saying that indicates to me that there's an audience for an alternative to corporate media.
Well, although his is also corporate.
It is corporate.
Let it be known. But, yeah, I think their audience is out there. And one of the things that you're seeing that is sort of a hopeful sign is that even journalism abhors a vacuum. And as the newspapers, the hard copy newspapers, are taking a hit, and cutting back on their reporters and so forth, you are seeing some things spring up in terms of community news services and foundation-funded operations and independent research and journalism producing organizations that aren't actually publishing hard copy newspapers, but they're making copy available to papers that want to use them. So maybe we'll get more and more of that, plus the amount of material that's available on the internet in the form of blogs or something like Huffington Post, where you have lots of people contributing at least opinion and in many cases independent reporting as well.
Well, I thank you for joining us here, Nicholas Johnson. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
All right, give me the call letters on your station.
It's KPFK Los Angeles.
KPFK?
Yeah, KPFK.
Oh, Pacifica.
Yeah, it is Pacifica, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay, yeah. Well, good for you.
Yeah, no, we're responsible for the seven terrible words, remember?
Oh, yes. No, I did a lot with Pacifica over
right.
the years.
Right.
All
well,
right.
You
well,
know,
listen,
yeah,
I wish you I must, well, and I thank yeah. you for calling, and I hope we've said something that you can use. Tell your listeners to hum along with us.
All righty. Let me.
You realize you Australians are responsible for getting this guy started in the first place.
Hey.
I think you have some confession to make to your
I
listeners.
Do. I do. I got to expiate here. Anyway, I got to wrap up here. So thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And again, I was speaking then with Nicholas Johnson, who was a commissioner on the Federal Communications Commission from 1966 to 1973. He's the author of How to Talk Back to Your Television Set and Your Second Priority, A Former FCC Commissioner Speaks Out. He currently teaches at the University of Iowa College of Law. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with, I thought, a very interesting economist, and his name is Matias Venango. He comes from Argentina. He's very familiar with Argentina's debt and default. And, of course, we're talking about the possibility of the Greece defaulting. He thinks it's not an if, but a when, and that they will default. And the real question is, will it be an orderly default or a disorderly one that will drag down the Eurozone with it and, by extension, American banks and slow down and the so-called recovery? And he pretty much thinks it'll be the latter because the politicians simply are not capable. They don't have the power against the power of these banks, which we certainly saw back in 2008 with the Wall Street meltdown. It really is a global problem that these bankers can make terrible loans, and the lenders are made whole. The borrowers, whether they're dictators or corrupt governments or just idiots, sometimes are held responsible. Mostly they're not. But at the end of the day, it's always the poor people that get squeezed and are forced to clean up the mess. And there's no better example of what's happening in Greece today. He thinks that Greece eventually will have to leave the Eurozone. But he gave a very, very good analysis of tying in lots and lots of other things to make this quite a big picture in terms of how finance has taken over the globe, and this too big to fail elite of bankers truly is running the world. I know it sounds conspiratorial, but I'm afraid he makes a pretty good case. Then we spoke with Ethan Rome, who's the executive director of Healthcare for America Now. It's a public interest group that is defending the much maligned healthcare reform bill. We talked about this so-called gang of six senators, $3.7 trillion deal that they're calling for. And, of course, the president's $4 trillion deal that he wants. And in both cases, we don't know a lot about how much Obama was prepared to give away with Medicare and Social Security. But in the so-called the gang of six senators, it's pretty clear what they want to do. And Ethan Rome really did make a good case of how devastating it would be for the Democrats to agree to this. In effect, the Republicans could run against them in the next election saying, the Democrats sold out Social Security and Medicare. It's almost incomprehensible that they would do that. But apparently, this is the deal in the name of bipartisanship. And of course, they're being bipartisan because, oh, we've got to deal with the debt issue. You know, well, the debt issue is a phony one. It's entirely created by the Republicans who have created this economic hostage crisis. And it's like the Stockholm syndrome, where they torture you and then you end up being nice to the torturers. Very strange. And then we talked with the former commissioner of the FCC, Nicholas Johnson, and he was so interesting and so wise. We talked initially, of course, about Rupert Murdoch, the too big to fail media mogul who doesn't know what's going on inside his company. At least that's the testimony he gave. And Nicholas Johnson really does. He says, you know, it all comes down to the fact that we've got the best government money can buy, and that not only have we allowed these people to take over the media, but they also are picking our politicians and deciding who gets elected and who does not. And he feels that it's time for the people, way past that time for the people, to wake up and not just take back their media, but take back their country as well. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.